Traditionally, in the summer, Northern Soundings takes a break. This year, however, is a little different. I'm delighted to reintroduce a new generation to a wonderful series KUAC broadcast some 30 years ago. Sunday at Noon and later Conversations featured Susan McGinnis talking with some historically significant and thoughtful people at the time about Alaska. Susan has selected six former discussions for this summer series. This show, we visit with environmental powerhouse Celia M. Hunter, who passed away almost 20 years ago.
For Celia Hunter, making a life has never been a matter of making money. Making opportunities, yes, and making things happen. She's been so successful at making things happen that such an unlikely source as the Alaska Journal of Commerce last year anointed her, and with no loss of irony, as one of the 25 most powerful people in the state of Alaska. Well, no doubt it's true, and no doubt for the Alaska Journal of Commerce that it's an ironic statement. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Please welcome now Celia Hunter. Hi, Celia. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Susan.
I want to ask you first about that first thought about making money. So many people who came out of the Depression, and I think so much so that it created the perspective of this entire nation, said to themselves, we will never be poor again. In fact, we will create money as a way of creating our security and as a way of creating our life. What happened in your Depression that didn't happen or happened differently than for others?
I suppose there were two ways of viewing the Depression, and one of them was that money is security, I'm going to get it regardless. And the other way was saying, I've been as far down as I will ever go, and I survived, and you don't worry after that.
So for you, coming up doesn't have anything to do with cash? What does it have to do with then?
I think it has to do with what you want to do with your life and how you want to be in the world. And money is merely something that is an added feature. I've never, that I can think of, been so broke that I couldn't do what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You cut your clothes to fit the cloth.
Uh-huh. Did your folks bring you that, or did the environment bring you that?
No, I don't think my folks did. I think my folks suffered very much during the Depression. I think my father was a working man and broke his arm just about 2 years into the Depression and lost his job, and we had to go on relief. That was painful. Mm-hmm. My parents did not find the Depression exhilarating in the slightest. I didn't either. For a while, I couldn't join the Rainbow Girls because they didn't have any decent clothes. And I'm awfully glad I didn't. I don't think I'd make a good Rainbow Girl.
But that meant a lot to a little girl at the time.
Well, at 15, it was important.
Yeah.
But basically, I just sort of moved along. And when I first got, I got my first job, and I earned $50 a month. And I bought a car that cost $50.
Now, that's a no surprise. That's a very young thing to do. This is Celia Hunter on Conversations. Was flying the first thing that, to use your word, exhilarated you?
I suppose it was. I can't say that being an invoice clerk for Weyerhaeuser or Timber Company was very scintillating. In fact, they said if I stayed on that I could become the head invoice clerk, and I looked across the desk at the head invoice clerk and I quit. I resigned. And got out and became an inventory clerk, which was more interesting. Learning to fly was exhilarating. My first flight as a student, on January 20th, 1940, was a clear, cold, crisp, beautiful day in western Washington. And when I got up and looked at the world from on high, I was sunk. That was where I wanted to be.
And it was space?
It was space. It was a viewpoint. The viewpoint from on high is so different. Just that whole feeling of being aloft gives you a feeling that the birds must have. In fact, I think if I wanted to be reincarnated, I'd like to be a bird of some sort.
That would fit. Did anyone hesitate when you went into the Everett Washington Field and said, I want to learn to fly? A girl in 1940, unusual?
Well, I think the thing I didn't realize was how hard up most of the pilots who were trying to earn a living instructing were. Jack, I can't remember his last name, Ellsbury, I think, he fell on my neck. $75 walking through the door.
Oh, it didn't matter what you looked like, did it?
Not at all.
This is Celia Hunter. She did start flying in 1940 through a civilian pilot training program, got her private license that year. A little bit later, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots Program was created, and Celia learned more flying skills and flew for it until it was disbanded in 1944. Some of the planes she flew, not lightweight, she ferried small observation aircraft and primary trainers throughout the east of the United States and the Midwest, but then was trained for pursuit train plane flying and flew across the United States and Canada in P-47 Thunderbolts, P-51 Mustangs, P-63 Air Cobras. What I guess about these planes is they go a bit faster.
They do.
What was that like?
Terrifying at times. The very first, we were in the Air Transport Command, the ferrying division, and they had a regular program for upgrading pilots. We had to go through instrument school at St. Joe, Missouri, and then we were sent down in, I went down in June of 1944 to Brownsville, Texas, to learn to fly pursuits. And Brownsville, Texas is not the place to go in the summertime. It'd be fine for a winter vacation, but it was hot. And my very first airplane was a P-47, and it was the biggest, heaviest airplane I had ever been in. And not only was it going too fast for me, even though I'd had some time in the back seat of an AT-6, I still wasn't prepared for that power, you know, 2,000 horsepower. And I got up in the air, and it was a very hot day, and they'd overfilled the wing tanks, and they started siphoning, and the fumes got in the cockpit, and I couldn't crack the hatch, and I was going nuts, and the flaps were down, the wheels were dragging, I was in disarray, and finally a very comforting voice got on the air. They have these experienced pilots who sat in the car at the end of the runway just to help people like me. And he talked me all the way around the traffic pattern, got me on the final approach, got me lined up, and said, okay, easy does it. And I just brought it down and landed it. But I thought I'd washed out.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
That was a grim experience. That weekend, we didn't fly, but I flew in my mind P-47 from the moment I woke up until I went to bed at night. And when I got in one on Monday, duck soup.
How fast?
It had slowed down.
How fast was that plane going?
Well, it went up to 250 or 300 miles an hour when we were in the, regularly flying. But you had to bring it down to about 150 miles an hour for the final descent in the traffic pattern. And I was afraid it'd fall out of the air if I pulled the throttle back, I guess. They warned us about this plane. If you ever stalled it, it just went boom. And to do a split S, you know, when you go up and you turn the airplane upside down and you come down like this, it took 20,000 feet for a P-47 to come out of a split S.
Oh, my goodness.
So I never did any.
Ever?
Ever. I never got to 20,000 feet.
Has flying for you dealt with kind of all those issues of self-doubt and uncertainty? I mean, it seems to me if you can crash a plane and figure out what to do and get back up in the air, or fly a plane at 300 miles an hour.
Well, I think probably that learning to fly was one of the major events in my young life, because I think when you become good at something, when you step out of the crowd and you're doing something that's a little different, you are making your way in something, doing something that is unusual, there is a lift to your ego that really gives you that start and that confidence that you can then go on and do practically anything. And I think that was what flying did for me. Up to that time, I was a small-town girl working in a lumber mill. And that made a difference, and that difference persisted.
I want to ask you for one more flying story, and it's the story about you and then Jenny Hill, a woman we know as Jenny Wood these days in Fairbanks, flying up to Alaska starting in December of 1946 and barely making it by January of 1947. I understand this is a 30-hour flight, and it was a 27-day adventure.
That's right.
Give us the high points. This sounds like an extraordinary adventure for a couple of small-town girls, frankly.
Well, it all came about because the Air Force wouldn't allow us to fly the P-63s and P-47s and so on with the Red Star on them from Great Falls to Fairbanks. That was the Northwest staging route. And the Air Force at that point claimed that they didn't have facilities for women on the Northwest staging route. Well, of course, they had. What they had was an escort plane, and they had mechanics along who did all the servicing and all that sort of thing, and all you had to do was fly the craft up the Northwest staging route. But we'd never been allowed to do it. And so after the war, it was still nagging at us, and we decided we'd like to go to Alaska. We wanted to go up and see what all these boys were talking about when they came back, and we're talking about Fairbanks and Galena and Northway and all this stuff. And so we started up in a sailboat the summer of 1946, but we didn't get very far. We got to the northern end of Vancouver Island, and we spent so much time going up every fjord that, you know, didn't have time. Then I got a chance to fly an airplane up, and the man who bought them, Gene Jack, he bought another airplane when he found out Jenny could fly. I asked if I could take her along, and he said, sure, can she fly? So we got two airplanes and hit it up. But took so long doing so many different things down in Seattle that it was December before we could get out of town. And we couldn't even go over the mountains then. We had to go south to Portland and up through the Columbia River Gorge at treetop level in order to get to Spokane. And then we started north, and the first thing we did was try to go through Crow's Nest Pass, short of Calgary, and ran into a snowstorm. And Ginny and I had gotten a little separated at that time. In fact, all three of the planes were separated. He was flying a twin-engine Cessna that was faster. He went through. He shouldn't have. He popped all the rivets on his wings. We, each of us, knew how to make a 180-degree turn, so we separately came to the mouth of Crow's Nest Pass, flew in a little way, said, whoa, this is not for me, and went back and landed at Kimberley. And we spent 5 days waiting at Kimberley for the weather to clear. He thought we were dead for part of that time. He couldn't imagine that we had turned around and gone back and landed in an airstrip. But anyway, we spent several days. Oh, by the way, in order to improve Ginny's airplane, which was unairworthy, he had it painted blue and gold in Calgary so that the RCMP would let it get past their inspection. Didn't improve it in much.
Did you at some point on that trip have to chip Ginny out of the cockpit because it was so cold?
Yes, and this was because of this airplane of hers, which was an L-5, and it didn't have range enough to fly this one long stretch between Teslin and Whitehorse. So they installed an extra gas tank in the back seat, and she was supposed to wobble it up to the wing tank when she ran out of gas, but they forgot to put a check valve in. So she had to wobble this way all the way after she ran out of the gas in the wing, and she had to wobble like this, and it was 30 below zero and colder. And we had sheep line flying gear, but it wasn't enough to keep you really warm, you know. And when she landed at Whitehorse, she was exhausted from this constant wobbling. And the other woman and I ran down and hauled her out of her cockpit and brought her in and thawed her out. And then, stupidly, we went on to Northway that night.
Oh, no. No rests, no warming up.
That was so we could get to Alaska the same year we started.
That's what I was going to ask. You pushed through and came in January 1st. Ladd or Weeks Field?
No, we landed at Weeks.
At Weeks. Almost landed at Ladd Kramer's
Field
Dairy.
Yes, we almost did. We were in a snowstorm by that time. That's another aspect of the story. But anyway, we formed up on the silo at Creamer's Dairy and suddenly realized that it wasn't the tower. Finally saw the lights blinking from the tower over on Weeks Field and found our way in.
Good thing for the cows and the grain. This is Celia Hunter, my guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. So you continued flying for a fellow Chuck West, who later founded West Tours, and for another outfit. She and Ginny flew in and out of Kotzebue, ferrying folks and setting up a travel lodge there, kind of an early tourism business from out of Fairbanks and in kind of relatively early Alaska.
Susan McGinnis talking with Celia Hunter on this historic rebroadcast of Conversations from the 1990s. Thank you.
want to ask you about the kind of establishing of the tourism business, as much as you participated in it in the late 40s, early 50s and 60s in Alaska. There was the Wien Kotzebue Lodge, and then later you and Ginny established Camp Denali. Mm-hmm. Tell me about kind of the balance between an emerging environmentalist view and kind of rough grade tourism that was going on at that point.
Well, you have to realize that environmentalism didn't even come into being until the late 60s, actually. There were conservation groups in the 50s, but they weren't very active. The Sierra Club was mostly an outing club at that time. And the real threats to various natural features were just beginning. The Dinosaur Dam controversy, you know, and the Green River there. And well, it was in the Dinosaur National Monument. They wanted to put a dam up the Green River. And that was a big fight. And they were talking about damming the Colorado River at some point there and so on. But when we hit Fairbanks, we were just interested in the people, interested in the country. The wonderful thing about Alaska at that time was that it was totally uncompartmentalized. There were no boundaries around any pieces of property. It was all federal. It was part of, you know, it was the open public domain. And so we crossed and recrossed Alaska without ever going through any property that belonged to anybody except the federal government. And some of it was set aside in parks and monuments at that time, and wildlife refuges, very small. But it was an exciting land, an exciting time. And I think our showing it to people was very important, not to convert them to anything, but just to let them share our experience of this wonderful land and its great people.
This was part of a new exhilaration, a mm-hmm. new love.
Right. Mm. And we had gone around Europe in 1947 and 48. We'd traveled for 10 months by bicycle across Europe in 1948. So we knew Europe, but Alaska was totally unexpected. It was so fresh and so unspoiled. And going out into Kotzebue when it was 600 people there and 90% of them were Eskimo, and the people from Little Diomede would come over and camp on the beach in the summertime and have their tents and do their ivory carving and mm-hmm. catching fish out of the Kotzebue Sound and so on. And that's all we wanted to do, was just to share that. And that's how we got into the tourist business, really.
And is that the kind of the spirit in which Camp Denali was established?
Yes, I think Camp Denali was an outgrowth of working with Chuck West and handling the first tour groups that came north under his auspices. And they would come through Denali from McKinley Park at that time and be very disappointed because the hotel was by the railroad. They had to go clear out in the park in order to see the mountain from a distance. And they just felt that there wasn't very much there. And we thought if you could just have a place out at in the heart of the park at Wonder Lake, near Wonder Lake, where you could see the mountain whenever it came out, what a treat for people, and what a treat to get out and hike the park and look at the wildlife and that sort of thing. And that's what we had in mind when we set it up.
And this was all tents and Primus stoves, right? We're not dealing with...
Oh, absolutely. We started out... We never borrowed any money. The most amazing thing about Camp Denali is that the financing came out of our pockets. And we started out, and the very first guest who arrived at Camp Denali in June of 1952 came 3 days after we ourselves had managed to get out over the park road. We had one tent platform down. In that day, the 3 days we had before they arrived, we had framed up the tent, itself, put the canvas over, and we're just preparing to inaugurate our very first tent cabin. And Bob Rice flew over, and we had 3 American Plan guests. A kitchen. We had a tent with a Primus stove. I cooked those scrambled eggs at 10:30 at night, I remember, for their first meal. And then we just entertained them by taking them out in the park.
And it worked.
It worked.
For 20, almost 25 years.
And we were never caught up with building camp ahead of the people who wanted to come.
Uh-huh.
And camp kept expanding and changing. And so much of it was what the people and our staff and the country told us to do.
Now, tell me about the emergence of an environmental view. we're almost up to a time now, 1960 or so.
Well, I think one of the things that did tip the scales in that direction was the field trip that Olis and Marty Murray made into up on the Shinjek in 1956. They went up and spent the whole summer. And Olis and Marty had been in the bush country of Alaska a lot in their younger years. And they had gone up the Koyukuk River to Wiseman on their honeymoon. And they had taken their infant son out to Old Crow and studied the geese in the Old Crow Flats and the Porcupine River and so on. And Olis knew, because he'd been associated with the Wilderness Society, that times were changing. And if they didn't start preserving some of Alaska as it was, that the development forces would overwhelm it and there would not be any really natural, not a whole ecosystem, for instance, that they could point to and say, this is what Alaska is or used to be. And that was why he was interested in that northeast corner, because up to that time, nobody thought there was any oil west or east of the Canning River. And they just felt that they'd be safe in going up there. And this was clear in the 50s before oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay. And that was their intent, was to outline the boundaries of something that of a reserve that went from the Arctic Ocean up over the Brooks Range and down into the boreal forest. And they wanted to have that whole ecosystem as an intact unit. And we supported that, a great many of us here, many people on the faculty at the university, and banded together to testify for the Arctic National Wildlife Range, as it was called.
And now refuge.
And now the refuge. Uh-huh. And out of that little group of people who testified unsuccessfully, we organized the Alaska Conservation Society, which was our first statewide organization, because the legislature was so chauvinistic they wouldn't listen to anybody coming from outside to tell them that they should save some of Alaska. And we said, well, we're Alaskans, we'll tell you.
Now, this sounds to me like almost a revolution in your thinking, that your eyes were opened at that point by the logic of Olis Murray. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, very much. Mm-hmm. I think you have to catch that concept and understand what can happen if you lose the elements of your biological network and so on. And I was taking classes at the university, too, at that time, so I had begun to understand ecology and begun to understand a lot of these things. And we just started the Conservation Society, and all of a sudden the 60s hit, and that was a boom time in Alaska.
The year the Alaska Conservation Society mm-hmm. was established, the first newsletter held this thought, March 1960. In most fields of endeavor, mistakes can be corrected. With wilderness and wildlife, you don't get a second chance. Alaska needs highways, farms, commercial and mineral development. But if in the process we lose that which makes Alaska unique, then we have paid too high a price. Is that an enduring philosophy for you? And mm-hmm. do you believe that wildlife and wilderness are kind of inflexible in that way, that once damaged cannot return?
I think they're inflexible if you push too far. Mm-hmm. I think that Alaska at this time still has a lot of open space and a lot of wildlife habitat, and that it's a lot of it is unspoiled. But you never know how close you are to the edge of pushing over to the point where you can't support these things. And one of the places where this could occur very easily is in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where we could lose that magnificent caribou herd by destroying their calving grounds on the coastal plain. And sure, the oil company said, we'll be very careful, and the caribou and oil can coexist, and they point to the central herd. But that is a very precarious existence those caribou have, and they are beginning to die off because they haven't got the basic necessities, and we don't want to see that happen to the porcupine herd.
In this kind of logic, do you see yourself as very conservative? That is to say, if we're not sure where the edge of that cliff is from which we can't return, we need to back a considerable distance off from it?
I hope so. I think that's true of all the activities that human beings are doing in the world today, that I prefer to be safe than sorry. Uh-huh. There's a lot of generations coming on behind us, and if they don't have any wherewithal to cope with survival, they're going to be in a bad way. And I think that, you know, this is the basic fundamental of what the environmental cause is about. Sure, it's conservative. We don't feel that you should take the chances of destroying something that can never be replaced or repaired.
So in this way, you literally look after the interests of the least in the long-term interest of the most, rather than looking after the interest of the most.
I don't think that's really quite the way you can say it. There is a law of ecology that's called the law of the minimum. And that basically says that you have to have this minimum, and that once you have dropped below that...
So many of this, so many of this, so many of this,
well,
this minimum.
Well, actually, the minimum can relate to air, it can relate to water, it can relate to bacteria in the soil, it can relate to a lot of things. And once you have gone below that, you do lose irreparably. But you don't have to get down to that minimum. And the problem is with a biologist, unlike an engineer who always is certain of the dollars that are going to be gotten from so much oil, from so much this and that and the other thing, a biologist can't say things positively. He has to say, we think. We, from our experience, we understand. And it is a very, it's not a strong way of arguing.
Right.
But it's better, again, I say, to be safe than sorry.
This is Celia Hunter on Conversations, and I'm Susan McGinnis. Celia helped to found the Alaska Conservation Society, as we said, in 1960, and she served that organization as its executive secretary for 12 years. The Alaska Conservation Society was disbanded in 1981 as other conservation and environmental groups came in to take over its work.
Susan McGinnis talking with Celia Hunter on this historic rebroadcast of Conversations from the 1990s.
Can you untangle some words for me?
Mm-hmm.
Preservationist, conservationist, environmentalist. They are sometimes each used as a proud title, this is my belief, and sometimes used as an epithet. The other side will say preservationist, going to lock up the world. Can you untangle those three? Do they mean different things?
Well, yes, there are. There are fine differences. I think... we talked a lot about conservation of resources in the early days, in the 1950s and the early 60s. And it wasn't until really you got into the Earth Day situation and the NEPA was passed, National Environmental Protection Act was passed in 1969, I believe. And at that point, you suddenly began to look at holes. You were not looking to save a particular area. You were not looking to save a particular species. You were not preserving just a little, you know, like having Mount McKinley in a park and then not worrying about any of the surroundings of it and so on. In the conservation movement, it was more of trying to get things into categories where they would not be destroyed and so on. I can remember in the Wilderness Society, we worked very hard to have citizens out looking at all the wilderness areas and saying, yes, I think it should go here and here and here, and you know, and it should take in this stream and that sort of thing. That's a much lesser approach to the environment than began to come with the realization that the whole of the earth is a biological entity.
Thus the Sether word, environmentalism, the entire environment.
The entire environment began to have some meaning. And I think that things like Silent Spring, where Rachel Carson was pointing out the devastating effects of DDT, which went, starting with insects, went all the way through the whole bird life and the animal life and people. And you look at breast cancer is linked to DDT now. And you realized that suddenly there was a much more holistic view of what life is and what the threats to it are. And I think with that moment, conservation of just, as a concept, became only part of the picture.
All right.
And the preservationist is mostly used as an epithet. We all want the preservation of something. You know, even here in Fairbanks, we have our neighborhood fights about whether they are going to cut down the trees along Belaine Road or whether they're going to save the Chena Riverbank or that sort of thing. We're trying to preserve something. And it depends on who you're talking to and what they're talking about. I was listening to Living on Earth, and there's this young man who had a little wetland there in Connecticut that he was determined to save. And he politically organized and saved it at the age of 14. We all want to preserve certain things. And it just depends if that preservation gets in the way of a developer who wants to put in a whole series of condominiums and that sort of thing, or whether it's the oil company that wants to drill or whatever. Mm-hmm. There are things we try to preserve, and what they try to do is to paint the whole environmental movement and the whole conservation movement as being preservationist.
They want to lock up our world. And, right. This next question, I don't know how to phrase it as a question, so I'm going to kind of present it to you as a problem and see what you can do about untangling it. There are so-called developers and so-called environmentalists in the world. In between those are a lot of people, I think, who have interests on both sides, perhaps yearnings in both directions, but who see the battle between the two as kind of a Hatfield and McCoy feud, where both sides engage in hyperbole, each side accuses the other of not paying attention to the facts, of over-emotionalism, of sensationalizing. One side says, the planet's going to be raped. The other side says they're going to lock everything up and destroy the economy. The problem, I think, is that the people in the middle with yearnings in both directions, a pocketbook that's not broke and a world to live in that survives, don't quite know where to come down. If you were to sketch the future of the movements, plural, would you change anything for the benefit of the people in the middle? Or do you think that these extremes have to battle each other out for the preservation of the people in the middle? It's a long question, forgive me.
Well, the situation is never just black and white. If you listen to the Timber Summit that was presided over by Gore and Clinton in Portland, as I did, you heard very cogent arguments on both sides. But I think the overwhelming truth to me that came out of that is that that the world is changing, and the people who now depend upon cutting down old-growth timber as a livelihood face an end to that occupation, either in the immediate future or in the somewhat more distant future. The question is, shall we preserve the old growth, the less than 4% of the old growth timber that's left, as an example of what the earth should be like, what the Pacific Northwest timber forest ought to be like, and work out other ways of providing jobs for those people and of providing housing for people and doing all the other things that wood does. And I think that we're an ingenious people. We have changed our way of solving problems of keeping people alive in a great many ways. And I think this is a test of our ingenuity as a species. If we have to destroy the very last vestiges of the timber or the whales or the caribou or the fisheries of the sea, what are we going to live on? How are we going to survive as a species? Because we're only one species among many. And when we act in an overbearing manner toward the rest of the species on the earth, we're going to get our comeuppance at some point, because we are inextricably linked with everything else. And we're just as vulnerable as the animals and the timber and all that sort of thing, which we can destroy so casually. And we've got to have respect for every aspect of our living environment. And what I think the future is going to mean is that we're going to make do with less. There's no reason that we have to have supermarkets full of junk. We can make things which last. We don't have to plan for obsolescence. We can make sure that the products that we use have a lifetime of use. If you go around our house, you'll find that we are using things 20 and 30 years that many people would have thrown away. I mean, you just toss it out. And I think there are many people who are today looking at the world from that standpoint, and that we can't continually press the earth to bring us more stuff that we can make more money.
This is in a time, though, when at least this economy and the people who support it are under constant pressure to discard the old or the semi-new and to find something new, better, that will work new, better, and for which they'll pay more money. I mean, the pressure against this logic is very strong.
I agree. I think it's extremely strong. But I think that over and above everything, Susan, the whole concept of the economy as we have, as we are looking at it today, is that the economy has to grow in order for people to be prosperous. The economy, in order to grow the economy, you have to make more cars. You've got people have to discard their old cars. They've got to get new ones. They've got to get rid of the shoes they have and get new ones. They have to do this. You've got to always have more and more of everything in order to keep the economy growing. But, you know, unlimited growth is cancer. And we are facing a future when we can't afford unlimited growth, either of population or of demands on natural resources or on the institutions that we put together. You know, we're not very humane to each other. I think that one of the things that really appalls me today is the tremendous increase of violence in the world and of intolerance and lack of sympathy for people who are different, the other. The other is becoming very, very much a prey to discrimination and that sort of thing. And I think we have so many other avenues of development besides just material growth. And I think if we're going to survive as a species, we're going to have to start exploring a lot of the other aspects of our nature other than the gimmies.
What's your sense of the success of the environmental movement as an educational force? It is, you're not only a someone who views the natural world around her, but you also take time to watch the human world around you. How well do you think America is doing at learning this lesson? Are the have-tos anything that we're ready to embrace?
Well, you know, it's amazing that there's never any monolithic truth about anything. And I think that one of the encouraging things is the way in which environmental education is permeating the whole educational system. And I think you find people are bringing the environment into arithmetic, they're bringing it into geography, they're bringing it into social studies, they're bringing it into computer things. You are finding that there's a much broader understanding of environmental considerations among the very young than existed in my generation. We didn't even think about it. I mean, that wasn't part of what we were worried about. We were just worried about whether our family was going to have a job and we were going to be able to go to school. And so I think that there is a really deepening understanding of the environmental outlook and so on from in the young. I think more and more people are beginning to understand that you can't demand everything from the earth forever, mm-hmm. that we're going to have to come to limits. We're going to have to come to limits in terms of our medical system. We're going to have to come to terms with limits in terms of how many people we can put into a given area. And we haven't any mechanisms for doing a lot of these things. It's going to be extremely difficult. We're going to have to really have some very, very... Either we're going to come up against some really drastic situations. You know, there's going to be a disaster which will bring this about, or we can do it by thinking about it. And, you know, there is going to be a limit to the way of the development of human populations. Maybe it'll have to come from famine. Maybe it'll have to come from war. Maybe it'll have to come from disasters. It would be much better if we could use our heads and plan.
Susan McGinnis talking with Celia Hunter on this historic rebroadcast of Conversations from the 1990s.
Once said, and I apologize because I didn't know of the source, but it's somewhere. You once said a wilderness experience is something for which people may now have to wait their turn, like the opera or the theater, where you have to buy your ticket and you can only go if there's room. The wilderness as no longer a right but a privilege?
Well, they aren't making any more of it. What we have now is all we'll ever have, and it's being encroached on continuously, as you know, from one source or another. And even too many people going to visit it can be destructive. When you look at Denali Park in the summertime, you begin to wonder if the carrying capacity of the park hasn't already been exceeded.
Now, the people on the other side would say to you, that's a lockup notion, and it means only the privileged will have the privilege. True? Does that matter?
Well, again, you have to come back to the situation of going to see Baryshnikov dance. The theater is limited. You buy your ticket, and if you can't get it this season, you may have to wait till next season to get it.
You don't begrudge Baryshnikov for the theater?
No, you can't.
Know
you can't
that
just
that's
try,
what's
to pu- try to push out the walls and say you've got to have more room. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much the case. You know, when I was young, the slogan was, visit your national parks, they can't visit you. And they were trying to get us to go out and visit the national parks because they were underutilized. Today, it's the opposite. They're overutilized, and we're trying to get the amusement center kind of things out of parks, put them out in amusement, put them in Disneyland where they belong, and let people go to the parks for the things that only the parks can afford. Can furnish to people, mm-hmm. which is that the natural beauty and the setting with wildlife in its place and all that sort of thing. And if I have to wait to go to see this in other places, that's fine because I know that it will be there. And if I'm not the lucky one that gets to go there, then there are going to be others who can and who can enjoy it in its magnificence. Mm-hmm. But if you just pack more and more people in, then every place on the earth is going to look like every other place. And why bother? I think that's the problem. If you packed, if you had the facilities, the number of facilities in Denali Park to take care of the increasing number of people who want to go there, you would pretty soon there wouldn't be any reason for them to go, mm-hmm. except to go and stay in a posh hotel. Mm-hmm. And that's not what a park is for.
Come to Alaska with me for a minute. And I was thinking last night about the phrase think globally, act locally. And I was wondering, and this is what I'm going to present to you, what do you think the best things being done in Alaska today are for the environment, for the long-term conservation, preservation of this state? What's best local action? And the other side is, of course, what's worse, but tell me what's best.
Well, I think looking at Alaska, that the best of what is happening is that there is a new consciousness of what Alaska is, and that it is at the same time very durable and very fragile, and that we have to look around where we are, we as residents of Alaska, and try to keep the area that we live in and that we use and that we utilize. And people in Alaska move around a lot. You've got a lot of people in Fairbanks who go down and fish in Bristol Bay, for example, and you've got people who are going out on construction, or they're going, they're doing a lot of different things. But I think the consciousness that you bring with you, and that people are beginning to recognize, that you have to take care of what's within your own domain in order to be sure that it's going to survive in a decent fashion, and hope that other people are doing the same. And I think that when you sit and when you look at the growth, for instance, of the environmental movement in Alaska over the last couple of decades, there are well over 100 different organizations. Some of them are very small. Some of them are very limited. They're just doing a very specific thing, like Alaska Survival is worried about pesticides. Well, I'm thankful they are, because when they send out a notice that I can write a letter about pesticides, then I don't have to be worrying all the time about pesticides, you know, the threat. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of these small organizations they coalesce into a fabric, but each one is an individual thread, and those individual threads are enormously important. And I think the most encouraging thing is that they are, by and large, creating new consciousness. And even the developers are beginning to start off. They always say, well, now I'm an environmentalist. And what they mean is that they have to tip their hat to the environmental well-being of the earth in order to do whatever it is that they are trying to do. And if they are prevented by laws and by people who say, no, that isn't what should be done here, we need this as a wetland, we don't want to cut it up with houses, we want to have a place where the sandhill cranes can come in, we want to have, just imagine if we hadn't preserved Creamer's Dairy when we did back in 1967 in the wake of the flood. And what a tremendous asset that is, not just to us, but to all these creatures that inhabit this place with us in the summertime. You know, it's that sort of consciousness, I think, that I see as the most hopeful thing in Alaska. And I see as the worst the continued emphasis on growth and the continued emphasis on extreme exploitation of all resources with the statement we've got to have jobs. And I think you need to question a lot of these things and say, jobs for whom? And where is the money going? And many times the biggest projects, the people who are going to staff them are coming from outside Alaska. The money's going to go outside Alaska. Let's support the smaller enterprises that are Alaskan and that can help the fabric of Alaskan life.
Is your sense that a lot of small resource or otherwise based businesses, whether those are in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Kotzebue, are the better idea than a large industry coming in, no matter how environmentally conscious it might be?
Well, I think it all depends. If you are the Chamber of Commerce and you're trying to build up your local community in terms of a bigger and bigger economy, so there's more and more jobs for more and more people, you would look for large-scale development. If you live here, you realize that the thing that really creates the fundamental fabric of Fairbanks, for example, are all of the people who are doing their own thing, who are producing things like Van Gogh, which is a very small tour agency that goes around and takes people into homes of Alaskans to show visitors what Alaska's really like. And your various woodworking concerns we have around here that many times are employing only a few people but are creating homes and creating beauty. And there's so many things like that that can do it. Of course, I know you're going to hear the argument that we've got to have all these big things or there's no basis for all of us to live. And to a certain extent, that's true. But you have to realize that there comes a point when we become just like California or just like the Seattle area, which is growing beyond bounds, like my home county of Snohomish County, which is just getting to be one ticky-tacky row of houses after another. And, you know, that may be progress of a kind, but it doesn't add much to the quality of living. And I think Alaskans pay a lot of attention to the quality of their lives.
This is Celia Hunter on Conversations. Celia mentioned that she was raised in the Snoqualmie area in the foothills of the Cascades in Arlington, Washington, born in 1919. She went through Everett Business College, then a semester in Linfield College in Oregon before the Women's Air Force Service pilots kind of caught her fancy, and she went off to serve her country. She finished her education in 1964 with a Bachelor of Arts in Botany from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with minors in economics and in anthropology. Celia returned to school to Tanawha Valley Community College in the 80s to study counseling. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis with Celia Hunter. What do you think the big battles ahead are for this state? Is it going to be ANWR forever? Or
it will be... There's always going to be pressure to open up ANWR, I think. Even if it becomes wilderness, gets wilderness classification, I think there's always going to be the pressure that there's oil, there's a possibility of oil there, and we need it. And I think that's... But I think the counterbalancing thing is that we are discovering that there is a limit to the amount of hydrocarbons we can put in the atmosphere, that there is a limit to the plastics that we can manufacture because we can't get rid of them, and there's a limit to a lot of things that oil does too. So that is something that is going to be played out in the next half century or century. The immediate threat that I see that I'm really worried about is the massive clear-cutting of the boreal forest within the Tanawha Valley State Forest and the state lands here in this area. And I feel that is a real, really difficult situation to justify in terms of the ways in which all of the people here in Alaska utilize a boreal forest background. And this is the native people, and it's the people who live here in Fairbanks. It's the people who live out in the bush. I think that that has to be done very, very cautiously and very carefully. And the whole, I think the biggest threat in Alaska always has been that we've looked for panaceas in terms of humongous projects. You look at the Delta Barley. We could have had a small barley business that could have been, you know, sustained. There are horses here that need barley. There are lots of things. But we had to go into it with a tremendous outlay of state capital and clearing of hundreds of acres of spruce to make way for barley fields. We have no viable barley industry left. Mm-hmm. We have we've got these grain elevators that we can't use and that sort of thing. But that mentality of we just go for broke on enormous projects, Rampart Dam, mm-hmm. the Susitna Dam, and the Project Chariot was another example of that. And we're so prone to get into these, and we get so partisan about them, and we are so vitriolic, the back and forth about whether they should or should not be done divides the communities and so on. We do have, though, a lot of people in particularly the Fairbanks area and the interior who have an underlying philosophy of why they live here. And they'd live here even if they lost what is now their major source of income. They'd figure out a way to stay. And a lot of people have.
Is that perspective you've described, does it have to do with being in the last frontier, the great land? We have to have huge ideas to match our mountains, to match our massive country?
Well, I don't know. I think the last frontier is always a place where imaginations can run riot and where every kind of scheme is, the same. In other words, there's very little judgment about, yes, we should do this sort of thing, but we shouldn't do that. It gradually comes out that way, but it's only because that's how things work out.
And is it the job of the environmentalists to put the reins on, to say no to bad ideas?
Well, I think we try to say no to bad ideas whenever we can, but I think we also are holding out an ideal of the kind of life and livelihood and quality of life that exists here now and that we'd like to see maintained. There's a positive aspect of environmentalism that I think is very often overlooked, and that is that there is a concern for maintaining a balance and maintaining a community here where we can have caribou wandering through our front yards. We saw a caribou down in our ski path yesterday, and we saw a little fox running down our path today. And you know, when you can live with nature and you haven't destroyed all of the cover that these animals require, you haven't you've interspersed your homes with fields and forests and that sort of thing, you have a way of living that is rooted in the natural world and still has a lot of the good things of the intellectual life, the cultural life that we as human beings require too.
Celia Hunter, thank you. Our guest today on Conversations, Celia Hunter, founding member of the Alaska Conservation Society, served that organization for 12 years of its life. She served on the Governing Council of the Wilderness Society, was, in fact, the first woman to head a national environmental organization when she was made executive director of the Wilderness Society in 1977. She has been a moving and profound force in the environmental movement, not just in Alaska, but nationwide. Thank you very much for spending time with us on Conversations.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Susan.
Susan's conversation with environmental pioneer Celia Hunter originally aired on KUAC in the 1990s. This summer, we'll be airing archival editions of Susan's show. For Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.